my pleasure to... is this... Where's Chris? Oh, you're there. I'm Claire MacDonald, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to the last ideas and aperitifs of the season. For those people who haven't been before, Ideas and Aperitifs is an informal dialogue, a kind of seminar, really, conversational environment where people from UAL doing current research, artists doing practice-based research, can talk about projects. We like to run it here because this is a very convivial atmosphere, and we'll be working next year between October and December with something I think we're going to call Ideas and Aperitifs Doubles, with pairs of people. And what we've done this year is that we've had a lot of people who've given talks about various aspects of their work. We have had very few painters, but I think the only other painter we've had was Rebecca Fortnum. I am really pleased to be able to welcome Mick Finch to Ideas and Aperitifs. And I have double agents to thank for my introduction to Mick Finch. I've been in the university for about 20 months, and I came across Mick's work when he gave a presentation at Crosscurrent, which is the seminar that double agents run to give artists at CSM a chance to talk about their work to each other. And I was really blown away by Mick's work. A lot of my own interests are in the relationship between writing, art writing, and performance. And I love the way that Mick's work operates both discursively and visually with ideas about mark making, about painting, about the way that the painting and the mark come off the page. And out of that experience, we began to have a dialogue and began to talk about doing a book together. In the meantime, ICFA has set up its own imprint, and actually I'm incredibly proud that this is taking us off the subject of Mick for a bit, but we have our first book, which has just come from the printers today, with a painter called Paula Kane, who works at Biome Shaw, and her project Studio Wall, which we're launching next week at the October Gallery on the 26th. And it's being distributed by Corner House, as will be Mick's book. And you can find out about it on our website. You can ask myself and Chris about that later on. So today, what I really wanted Mick to do is to just talk about his work. The way I see his work, which may not be quite how Mick sees the work, is really as a dialogue between two very clear aspects of Mick's practice, one of which is actually profoundly discursive, to do with the way in which his work appears in and realizes itself through language. And the other one is really thinking about the limits, the boundaries, and the possibilities of the mark, as I see it, and the image. And I think everything else I can leave to Mick himself to discursively extrapolate. And I'm just going to switch off the light now. And then we'll have time for questions at the end.
Right. Well, I'm going to... it's going to be a bit strictly boring the way I'm going to do this. I don't see any other way than, in a way, giving a background that actually goes way back. But I'm going to skip through a lot of things. I think it's very important just to have a sense of what I've been up to, I'd say, since about, profoundly since 95. And it's really as much as what Claire's saying, which is accurate, there's a relationship between, I suppose, a discursive territory and practice. That discursive territory is to do with the fact I've written since about 95. But also I put into the pot that it's about teaching. I sort of do see teaching, writing, and practice as really conjoined. And I'll go through this particular moment that actually teaching has really transformed and provided forks in the road for me at times. There's one paradigm which really exists in the work, which is to do with the fact that before I was working at CSM, I was living in France for, I can't remember how long, about 17 years. I was teaching there for about 9 years. And there's a sort of cultural aspect, certainly to things which one, I think bluntly, one would call formalist ideas, and what would, in a very schematic sense, would be a two cultural formations of those, which which I've had various contacts with, and I'll talk about those as I go. So what I'm going to do is show the work, but also show some key contextual aspects, and also sort of talk about how I arrived at. I mean, what I want to do first of all is just go way, way back, in the sense that one thing that really I had to, I think, identify quite early on was that the way I was taught formed a particular vision of what I understood about certain things. And one of these was about notions of abstraction, which the sort of education I had at Art School of Ravensbourne and then Royal College, very much in the background of the 80s, which is to do with sorts of senses of lyricism, and lyricism being related to a type of abstraction, which inevitably, in an English context, get linked to landscape. And just to give you some background to that, that's what I was doing last year, and I'm quite embarrassed to show these now, but I'm going to do it anyway. just to show, in a sense, what I had to work, I was working out from, in a way. And I was at Royal College about 85, and I was really working within a context of certainly that, I think for many painters who were around at the time, that appalling aspect of the new spirit of painting and sort of coming out of a sort of domination of, put it bluntly, Greenbergian formalism. What I found myself doing instinctively, I haven't gone any back further back than the Royal College, was I tried to make paintings which were, in a sense, coming out of a certainly a European background, relationship to certainly artists like Braque and Matisse, which I think was quite current at the time. But the aspect that I think I was trying to identify there was a relationship between abstraction, signification, image, but totally, I don't think it's so naive looking back at it, but it what was characterized was two things, I think. One was a kind of visual complexity, and the other was a resistance to reductive forces, is the only way I could put it. And this was done, I think, completely intuitively. And if I say to you, for example, at the Royal College, I was there 82 to 85, somebody like Michael Fried, who's, you know, a completely standard theoretical component of discourse of painting, was completely absent as somebody we'd know about, would be taught about. And it took me a lot longer to get to sort of basic knowledge of, like, even how sort of certain formations of UK American painting was working. But the thing, I'm sort of rushing through these ones, but what happened between here is that these are paintings that are called Sodium Nights, they're a kind of distillation of literally a very empirical, impressionistic idea of picture making, really. Then I went to France, and I started making paintings where there were lots of pretexts to what I was doing. Pretext in these ones, which were then 17, was using, by the way, sorry, the projector's incredibly grey, incredibly dull. They are a little bit more colourful than this. They're quite a lot more colourful. One of the things I tried to do, I think because I was, it was the first time I'd lived abroad or lived outside of a very familiar context. I was living in a small town just north of Paris. I was driving in a lot to Paris, and I was driving on this road called the N17. And what struck me, because most of the Between Songs, which is a very picturesque French, mainly 18th century town, and then into the suburbs of Paris, was driving through this landscape which was very flat. There was Charles de Gaulle Airport and it's kind of hinterland. And the thing that interested me was the impression that kept building up through successive, since repetitive journeys. And what I did was made paintings which tried to tap into that. I don't think they were terribly successful at all. But what I started to do was use something called the calcomania paper, which is silkscreen paper. And it's a water-soluble gum-coated paper. And I was painting onto the paper with oil paint, putting it in a vat of water. The gum would release and it was backed onto the canvas. And so it was, in a sense, using a transcriptive process to build up these paintings. And what was happening was that I was starting to build them in terms of like the thickness, the notion of the thickness of the painting. And what that started to do was, in a way, question the terms, certainly by which I'd understood some of the ideas like flatness, especially through looking at, say, people like Matisse, an earlier American painting, for example, and actually from a BA education, being really very, very in contact with subjected to Greenberg's ideas. They were very dominant in the 70s. And what increasingly I came to be interested in was this sense of how the surface was built up. And actually how this sense of thickness could be very, just let this person in.
Yeah, sure.
Hi. And those paintings I just showed you were shown in threes. They were on the square, and they tended to work in threes. And what I started to be interested more was the sense that the way one would dissemble the other, how they would work in a kind of conversation. And at that point, I sort of started to sort of shed that protectional aspect of wanting to access and experience like a road journey. And I really just got more interested in the structuring of the paintings in very specific terms. And for a brief moment, I made these sort of box-like structures. This is about 95, which were working into repetition. They were like postcard size, small ones. So this idea of reproduction and possibly an original. I made a number of those, but they quickly transformed into these paintings, which became called Tri-Square. And at this point, I really started to work into very definitive series, which really would focus on particular mechanisms of painting. And particular, I think later I would call them, I think, rhetorical aspects of painting. And the background to these ones was in a way, using some of the, I suppose, all over, or not quite monochrome strategies, but strategies of painting which one would associate with a very reductive idea of painting. And I put them together. I can't remember exactly how big these are, but they're 1 meter 20 by 40, so they're three squares basically. And I actually never showed these until very, very recently. These were test bed works, just trying to, in a sense, generate. God, that's so bright. Trying to generate, I think I'd use the word strategy, and also to negotiate or interrogate very particular ideas, and also in a way it's to do with that context, the 80s, in terms of simulationist painting, pictures, etc., that sort of area from the 90s, whereby the abstraction as representation was really the key question. I became very interested in that. What happened then, as I started to make a series called Closer Than You Think, this is 96 to 98, and the first part of that was, in a way, trying to bring these three separated, in a way, one plus one plus one equals another product into one painting. Again, using the decalcomania paper, ways of building up surfaces. In a way, it's kind of play between surfaces. And also using grids. I don't know how evident it is, but a painting like that, the grids that are laid down are... It's quite a complex play between horizontal and vertical processes. And a painting like that started to introduce a quite informal aspect, whereby the paint in the middle would move the canvas, and the paint would drip through a gridded field. And it felt like a scan in a way, which was to read the surface, and, highly built up, encrusted surfaces. Then, in a sense, having a more informal element, which would literally read across it. I was thinking of the sense of elements literally bringing something into play in a transcriptive sense. Now, what happened then was I went to London from Paris, and I saw this advert. It's called "The Magic is Closer Than You Think." It's an advert for Disneyland, and I was very struck by something about the image, in the sense that it's an incredibly simple image, which it's a tunnel. It's Mickey Mouse. It's also a tunnel, because it's at the end of the tunnel. The other side says, "Guess what's waiting at the other end of the tunnel?" But it's just struck me how fast one went to identify what the image was. And it set me off on a trail of thought in terms of thinking of how... in a sense, Gestalt properties for working in communication models, and how, in a sense, an aspect of minimalism, which in a way created a discourse around painting, particularly with Judd. I'll go into this more detail in a second. How Gestalt qualities had, in a sense, dominated one way of making, mainly that minimalist to conceptualist reductive idea, which has all sorts of powerful and useful ends, but it also suppressed this sense of the complexity of an image. So what I did was I started to, this is the first one I did, very ruggedly use elements of this Mickey Mouse motif and just embed them, make them disappear into mechanisms, tropes of painting, which are paraphernalia of all over gridded works. For example, in there, there's it's more evident here. It's a very highly complex grid that's masked up, which in it there's a barely visible shape, and the shape is kind of just there as a presence. You're not quite sure what it is. It is this shape of the Mickey Mouse head again, and the sense of how that advert was working in terms of the magic is closer than you think, that something's happening on an automatic level, it's happening without you even thinking, that there's this almost insidious presence at work. This sort of sense of an underneath or something below the surface. I wanted to introduce them into these, into a regime of painting which doesn't usually, I suppose, host that type of presence. Again, this was using some of those strategies I talked about earlier on. Surfaces built up. There's aspects of this image at work. You can see it probably more profoundly on the left. Paint is loaded up onto the canvas and dripped through and revealing. So it's white on white, and the black is dripping or being pulled from left to right. And that's a type of scan revealing these networks. In a painting like this, it's barely visible there. It's just about visible there. The ground was a white ground, regrounded with a very thick white paint, and then using the top of a Mickey Mouse sweet box encrusted into the surface, just making the shape, printed into the surface. And again, the paint would be reading across from left to right, revealing, in a sense, this invisible aspect, or this hardly visible aspect. And that's the source of that image. But to go back into the background of that, the sense increasingly for me, and this is something I don't know how much detail I'm going into it, but with the moment of minimalism and the relationship to painting, and certainly in a context between Europe and America, at this moment, this is when I started to get interested in theory. I was teaching at Parsons at that point. I started writing them as well for Contemporary Magazine, just by accident actually. And it intensified as more I came to certainly think about minimalism in the light of Michael Fried's Beholder Discourse, Art and Objects, and actually realising this piece by Morris is actually a completely critical piece in relationship to Greenberg's idea that if you put a piece of canvas, you just tacked it up on the wall, it would be a painting, but not necessarily a great painting. But by slitting it like so, and it drop into the floor, so there'd be a relationship between the thing as a flat surface and as a shape and as a three-dimensional object, that he was in a way opening up Greenberg to other discussions, but it's a directly critical piece. The other aspect of Morris, which I was less sympathetic to, was the Gestalt aspect, that the idea of simple form, primary ABC form, for example, and the sense it came much more through Judd that European painting and sculpture, especially painting, was compositional, was internal, and it needed the viewer to, in a sense, dissemble it. Whereas what again, Judd would identify as an American sensibility, where you wouldn't have to look into it; it would dissemble itself. It would, in a sense, extend out automatically. These are key discourses of the minimalist period, which have a huge impact on how painting's been understood, mainly in American, I'd say, well, obviously in this country, UK-American access. And the question I kept asking, especially with this advert, was that actually the power of this image is totally in terms of a Gestalt effect, that you go from the part to the whole automatically. You really don't have to think about it. That's what's obviously the power of the image, also is quite terrifying of its efficiency as an object. And it made me ask questions about, well, is there a difference between an artistic model and a communication model? It's something I still play with. The other thing that was increasingly important, at that time, Yves Alain Bois was being read a lot, painting as model. But he wrote an essay called A Picturesque Stroll Around Clara Clara, which was about Smiths and Sarah, where he actually talks about the difference between a Gestalt image of something, holding something in one's head, and an experience of it. And I'll come back to Clara Clara. Basically, with Clara Clara, what he was saying, the power of that piece was that as you walked around it, it changed, it shifted. It would shift in terms of your expectation of what it is as a totality. And that he attributed this to a sort of parallax effect, that your relationship changes with the object in terms of your position to it, which is something you could easily attribute to a sort of way a cubist painting maybe works. But these aspects of the whole to the part were very important at that point in trying to think through various aspects of things. I'll come back to that in a second. Rush through a bit here. But this, The Closer You Think series, which I showed about 3-4 times, I then extended into really picking up on this difference between a kind of European and American point of view. For example, here I'm using that strategy where I'm laying the shape into the interior part of this image, and the exterior is camouflaged, it's American trellis camouflage from the 60s. And there's a play between visibility and invisibility, and also senses of presence. Again, this insidious aspect was interesting to me, but also a sort of hegemonic relationship to the image at that point, and how, in a way, process isn't just innocent, it's not just phenomenological, about quite, how would you call them, sort of very primal ideas of presence, that maybe presence can be something that you can talk of, think of in other terms. So the paintings then start to move into other areas, which are really broadly, I'd say, they're touching into rhetorical and later very specific aesthetic concerns. So I'm going to rush through these a bit. I don't want to linger too much. But for example, the sense that the camouflage is highly visible at this point, and yet it's a trope of invisibility. And then what's going on in the interior of this painting, I'm not sure I'm going to be very clear, but it's got embedded in here these shapes of the Mickey Mouse head. It was playing into a very, very prescribed area. And actually from this point on as well, I started to get involved with transcribing, permutating the image, using, at this point as well, I'm starting to use projectors. I'm starting to use, actually at this point there were cut stencils. I'm using more and more strategies, I think a distancing strategy as well in the studio, similar way to using decalcomania paper in one sense, but ways of also just projecting one thing from one place to another, by an image of sorts. But all the time from here on, there's a kind of use of highly schematic shape, which is on the edge of being something else, which is what Benjamin Butler calls factura, the sense of like the point which something turns towards signification. Well, he doesn't call it factura, it was a term that was used in Russia in the constructivist period. These paintings went on for about 2 years. What then became very important, I made a series, as it says there, playground, was this sense of having a multiplicity of things in one place, in a way, which was going on from the tri-square paintings. I got very, I think, overly interested in making these very intricate networks, almost like knotted networks, whereby they'd be masked out very intricately. For example, in this one, as you can see, there's a dripped aspect with the vertical drips, which is webbed into a sort of Mickey Mouse repeated motif. What happened in that was that the actual masking up became more interesting. What I noticed was that I was using very low grade masking tape, and it leaked. I'll show you this a bit later, but the transcriptive moment, in the sense that where the leak would happen. So, what, for example, I'll show you with some paintings that come up in a second. I'll get back to that. But before that, the thing that really came to light at this point was I thought the only way to describe this kind of paradigm, in a way, again, Yves-Alain Bois expresses it in the introduction to Painting's Model. He talks about the two formalisms. He talks about one being, in a sense, European. He's really relating to constructivism. He's very interested in signification, in a sense, production of value. And the other being American, and in that sense, open to being used, instrumentalized, however you want to describe it. The other being an American formalism, which is more in terms of autonomy and in terms of very different ideas of specificity. And what I became increasingly interested in was this expanded field, which was really being the expanded field in painting, which I don't know if you're all aware of that sort of use of Rosalind Krauss's term of the expanded field in sculpture, in the way of describing the move from minimalism to conceptual art through land art into ideas of category. So the limit, in the sense of extending from the work into the space, into an institution, into the world, etc. This idea that was applied to painting, I'd say from the 90s on, here with Polly Applebaum, Stockholder is the one everyone always talks about. She always gets caught up in that context. James Hyde, I think more interestingly. But in France, there was an equivalent. Philippe Richard, he's about 50. Edouard Poulier and Miguel Mont. But what I suddenly became aware of was another example of it, and actually really very specifically French, and actually bearing out from the writings of Hubert Damisch very particularly, especially a book called Fenêtre Jaune Cadmium, which is from the 50s, which has never, it's not so far been translated, where he's talking about the thickness of perception. He's talking about specificity of painting in terms of thickness, and the volumetric aspect of painting. One can be expressed in terms of, in a way, manipulating the support in different ways. In Hontai, he's died recently. I couldn't find a contextual slide. It's a very large painting. It's a grid. What he would do is, with the unstretched canvas, he folds what are the white parts in and knots them at each corner. So he's folding, it's very hard to explain, but he folds along these tramways, along the gridway, and then knots them, and then paints it all blue. So he's got one point of blue monochrome. And then he breaks it apart, he breaks the knots, and then it reveals this grid. So it's a sort of making that goes from manipulation of the three-dimensional surface to the 2D surface. This is another one. These ones are, the one on the right would be wrapped up in like a ball. And then he'd paint that, so you'd have a blue ball, and then unpick it, and then stretch it up. So there's a relationship between the expanded aspect, the relationship to volume was through manipulation. So the relationship to the image I found very different. Hontai's just died. He was very active from the 50s on, and Georges de Houdman's written a lot on him. Some very good things. And the other aspects which were increasingly becoming clear to me were support surface. This is Daniel Deserves, where this aspect of the grid again is volumetrically expressed in a way which, I mean, I'd express it myself as not just about the colonization of painting, colonization of space by painting. It's actually it's looking into the mechanism of painting in a strange way, a sense of like the grid unrolling, bringing into play all sorts of references. Another one's Patrick Saint. Actually, it's not Saito. I made him say it's a guy called Billier. I think it's Billier. B-I-O-U-L-E-S. But it's this tressage process of, in a way, look into aspects of work which, aspects of painting which are at a very, I'd say, an infra-thin level of the painting. They're quite subtle. François Rouen's another. He literally cuts up, say, two canvases and then weaves them together. Lacan wrote a very famous essay about these, in the sense that when you're looking at it, you're only seeing half materially what's there. And this aspect of something much more about, in a sense, a volume, but also about image, about thickness, if you like, thickness of perception, in a sense, started to interest me much more. And I found myself actually being quite antagonistic, feeling quite antagonistic or critical toward this other, I thought, rather gratuitous, expansive idea of painting, which was very prevalent at the time. This is Christian Bonfoy, who was part of a group called Jeanne d'Arc. Bonfoy worked with Yvan Ambois. They were both students of Hubert Damisch. And he works on both sides of a canvas. He works on something called Tarlatan. So this, again, this sense of the extension is very, I find, very subtly played. It's very, I think, subtly understood by a lot of these artists. And also they position themselves very, very carefully, very particularly. This is Dominic Figuarella, who's an artist in his 40s, I think, who, for example, here makes a puddle, photographs the puddle. He then makes a photographic image of it, cuts it out, and lays it into the painting. There's a sense of... it's a bit like a box with the sound of its own making, in one sense. But there's a relationship between, another state, its reflection, the mirror aspects, in a sense, and position, verticality, horizontality, things like that. And I was finding these things increasingly interesting. I'm going to rush through these. All I would say about these ones is I became very interested in monochrome and was using just purely this vestigial aspect of the leak of paint. I'd mask up this network. The first coat would be white, it would leak, and the second coat would be the same as ground. And this accident, in a sense, started to inform all the work I made, I'd say, till quite recently. But I then made a series of three-dimensional works, which they certainly were using this idea of parallax, in the sense that they were like exploded paintings, going actually in four directions. They're quite hard to describe. I mean, the only way I can really do is flip through them. But as you go round it, the back would be a grid. You go round the side, be another grid, half interspersed with this Mickey image, and coming around into the full sort of Mickey motif there. Oops. Sorry. And then into one which is interspersed between camouflage and grid. And the thing that interests me with this was you could only really understand it by moving around it. And it started to, the sort of questioning that it would provoke interested me. It was called riposte because it was this idea of an answer to some of these other questions of extension, expansion, which I was thinking of. This was another one from the same show, showed these ones in Paris. Which was using the sense of the thing unfolding again, that so only some of it is visible, that you have a sense that there's a thickness of something at work. There was another series called Sublime, which in a way I was using heads again. I don't know how much detail I should go into, because everyone gets the later ones, but the thing that was at work here was, in a sense, using actually 18th century ideas of the sublime, but also heads again, this time the Queen's head, but also vanitas heads, skulls, but also using a kind of sequential idea of laying the image down, using the dripping, the entrelac of the painting to, in a sense, inscribe the image in. And one like that uses a rotation of a skull. There's a movement that goes on that you can detect. You can actually you can unload it by looking at it. But the other thing that was going on here, increasingly I was using images which I was modifying in Photoshop, getting off the internet much of the time, but using projectors, at this point actually very low-grade projectors, to transcribe. I actually wrote an essay about this point called Night Shift, which was about the sense of the increasing fact that painters' studios are black, like they're looking at projected images all the time. This again seemed to be interesting. This space of the projection seemed to me to be very important. That again, it's kind of notion of the expansion. So you know, this accident, the vestige, if you like, of the mask. It's absolutely what these works were made of. They were like a very graphic element, which I started to use. But increasingly, what happened with these, but these are quite large paintings, by the way, these are about, well, large by my standards anyway, about six, just over 2 meters high. But with these sorts of paintings, what started to happen was the interest actually turned to this kind of taxonomy, which it introduced. The gridding, in a way, which has been present with Closer Than You Think. The use of the grid as a trope, I suppose, for an idea of abstraction, which one could read through in various ways. Here, what interested me was the flatness and the depth of the painting started to operate in different ways and actually started to bring up ideas of archive and displacement of the image in various ways. I mean, it started to produce different readings. And I played with this in various ways. For example, in here there's a Fender guitar and there's a very complex camouflage drip system at the top. Encrusted with a skull, and this sort of way of combining images started to be what the work was about. And I found myself this was a series called Nevermind, where it just got pulled into colour. The drips were not always there. It was actually about combinations, a kind of engrammatic impression, almost I'd say composition, which interested me. And also the sense of how shape could float between being a very primary element or something which is very literally what it is. These are quite big as well, about 2 meters high. But this sort of sense of like producing a thickness of the painting in these terms. Was done alongside making paintings like this one, which were very much in the flat space, in the sense that the naturally gridded space, whereby other readings could be produced. And this flatness depth model is what has actually driven the work from about 2003 on. And also it's taking me into the sense that I'm printing these out onto, because to project them up, I'm using overhead projectors. So I'm going to Photoshop the painting like that one, for example. I can literally produce them as prints, they're masked out in a particular way. So there's a kind of transcriptive aspect which was fascinating me in a sense. I mean, this one's directly printed out from the internet. It's the, I'm really bad because I get told off by people. I can't remember if it's the Star Trek fleet or it's the Star Wars fleet. I should know really. And I make terrible mistakes. I think they're Klingon, so I think it's Star Trek. And I'm able with some of these. This one, for example, I've made that painting about 6 times now, different sizes, and exhibited it in different ways. It was just a collection, literally a collection of skulls, and that's what it looks like by the way, in size terms. And this started to turn the work into something completely, completely different. Rushing through. And this painting here is a painting I showed actually in London, is a complete description of that, in the sense that there's a repertoire of shapes and they're permutated and arranged, literally composed, the word I would use is composed in different ways. And it says producing in very productive in different ways. Now, what was going on there was, and this was actually from teaching actually in France, I was teaching with an Italian woman called Fulvia Canova, who, philosopher, she now is half of a team called Claire Fontaine, who and she's a philosopher who's worked with a lot with Rancière and Agamben, and also Walter Benjamin. And the discussions we had brought me to sort of think about these types of models, these schematic models. The one on the left is the that kind of Kleinian schema that Krauss used in the expanded field in sculpture. The one on the right is one that actually Susan Buck Morse used in a book called The Dialectics of Seeing about Walter Benjamin's passage work. And the sense here of like relationship, material relationship to the image, started in a sense just chime in terms of ways sort of certain things were happening in the work. And it's led me into a very particular set of references. I mean, first of all, with Benjamin, and then, of course, Warburg. There was Warburg's reception in France was very particular, mainly because of a book by Georges Didier Huberman. Well, it's an introduction by Georges Didier Huberman, a book by a guy called Alain-Philippe Michaud, about Warburg, Warburg's relationship to the pathos formel, and these things called planches, where he was tracking, in a sense, the transmission, the movement of an image, basically from pre-Renaissance into Renaissance. And this is something he did right at the end of his life. He showed at the end of his life, and also with a planche like that would be tracking how images would move in terms of advertising in relationship to much older forms. So he's looking at things like relationship of gesture, etc., things like that. But this sort of sense, like organising things in these ways, started to interest me. And of course, the other one's Richter's Atlas, the sense of how organisation of material, the relationships between things, which have been at work in some of the earlier paintings I was doing in a much less profound sense. But I was finding myself using the computer, the archive of the computer, to generate things progressively. And what I found myself doing, for example, with that sequence called Nevermind, I was doing this just for my own ends, really. I haven't never particularly shown it, but it's a sort of parallel practice thing that interests me, like between the Elvis Presley and the London Calling, or the Clash, the Nevermind of the Sex Pistols, to just that other use of the graphic, to the Nirvana Nevermind, and then the last one's when I just plugged in. I mean, it's silly, it's not particularly that interesting, but it's a sort of pathos formel, sense of a progression or a transformation. And what I did quite recently was just, in a sense, unload all of the planche I'd made, the overhead projector transparencies, and turn it into a show. I just projected them up and painted them. I'm just going to show you also at the same time the sense, I mean, to talk about the archive and relationship to that. I mean, the use of the website, you can see, I mean, with a PowerPoint, it's very particular how one describes how things are progressing. For example, these, I call them planches. These were paintings, as you can see, they're 116 by 73 centimetres. This is one progression, using different collections, different dynamics between images. That's actually stolen from Sol LeWitt completely, in terms of implementation of a cube. It's his famous piece, actually, King Krauss used in an essay, which actually seemed to be very pertinent in terms of, like, say, certainly how that works, for example. It just seemed very opposite. But at the same time I was making these paintings, I was also making these things I call dispositif, which For example, that one there. I'm sorry, the reproduction is absolutely appalling. But this one here has really transformed the practice recently. These are happening at the same time. I tend to have a very fragmented practice where I'm making things in parallel. Now I'm working between London and France. I've got two studios. I tend to make different things in different studios. And this website actually describes much more accurately the practice today and like the types of progressions and the switches and the jumps that are being made. And actually how it doesn't often make sense, you know. And whereas a PowerPoint is quite hard to relay that. Also quite hard to get back into. So I mean, yeah, this is how these paintings are made. This leak of the masking tape is present in all of them. Sometimes barely visible, but this sort of sense of a transcriptive moment seems to me very important to maintain. And same time, I did a show in Paris at a gallery called Christian Aubert of these planches. I did a, in the sense they're coming off the internet quite often. I then made an internet-based book, which was, I mean, this is the PDF of it. If you know what a Lulu is, it's a Lulu. It's made in InDesign. Oh, bloody hell. And it basically returns the images to, because at one point they are Photoshop files. And in a sense, it just returns them to another state. This sort of sense of how they're passing through different states, these works, was seemed to me to be very important in the way. And actually, that it is an internet-published book was very, very important. And there was a project, which I'll talk about later, which has been postponed for the moment, which I'll show. Anyway, which relates to that. Then we're in the last phase, sorry. Almost there. The work I'm doing now, a lot of it doesn't quite add up because I'm working on. I'm not sure quite where to go myself, so I'm actually opening it up to scrutiny in a way. But I'm making now these reliefs where I'm incorporating some of these planches into. They're like these ones, these are the earliest ones. Shapes are cut out. There's this roll motif which you saw in the sort of sense of a roll of canvas, if you like, coming through, which was present in, say, the riposte works. There's a sort of conjunction of lots of different strategies coming into singular works now. I'm not quite sure really where they're going. I'm actually using. There's none here. I'm now using laser cutters to cut these shapes, and some of them have got three layers, and ones like this are using a print form in the background. Also revisiting some older motifs. This one's got a print form in the background, and I'll show you what the print form is in a second. Sorry, the slides are very burnt out. This is a very ultramarine blue. This is one that doesn't make sense. I'm using some, it does make sense. I think it's where there's another work to come. I've got a whole set of fake Warhol Marilyns, which a silkscreen artist in Belgium who I used to work with made. And they're absolutely amazing. And I'm now embedding those into works and using those. Alongside that, there's this sets of prints being made. And this is a result of working at CSM, and actually having to really try and understand the print areas more carefully. They're A2 prints. But they're using these constellations, these repertoires of forms, on a very small level. Like, so here, I didn't bring any. These are absolutely tiny. They look like pin bricks. But when you approach them, get up close, they are distinct. They have distinct character, identities, etc. And this sort of shift this against this depth aspect of the interrogation of the image, the near far, has been transformed now in terms of sort of reprographic aspect. These are not. And the Queen's Head, I didn't really go into it, but the Queen's Head I'm using, not because I'm a royalist, but I was quite interested in a rather tyrannical panoptic shape. Also something that expresses, I mean rather crudely, ideas of sort of sovereignty and a sort of, you know, something that's inside and outside, a sort of state of exception in a sense. So I keep returning to this the monarch's head in a way, keeps coming back into the work. It's another print there. So I'm working on these are all printed off of Epsom plotters onto actually etching paper. And the thing about Epsom plotters, which I never realised before, is they have two black reservoirs. So the blacks are incredibly intense, and also the resolutions you can work with are extraordinarily fine, and they're exploiting that. And there's another level that I'm working on in parallel to that. There's about three or four works. This is appropriations of the Earth image, which is the most published image, I think, that exists. And I was just downloading different resolutions of it and made that into an A2 print as well. So it's really working with these ideas of resolution and then scale, actually, things like that. It's very within a specificity of digital print in a way, but also of image as well, almost at the end. And actually, this is the one which I was working on, I've had to abandon it. It's going to be a handmade book with, you know, not an internet published book, but a book which uses absolutely specific Epson output quality, which is the same image and it plays into the resolution. And that's what I'm working on pretty much now. Anyway, it's a bit of a rush through. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Thank you very, very much. We open the windows a little bit, buy ourselves up with a bit of a drink, and then we'll kind of bring Mick down to the front and we'll have some questions. Does that sound like a good idea? If you'd like to get water or wine, it's up here, especially the people who've come.